What's the universe at time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The man thought to be behind a series of bombings and attempted bombings in New York and New Jersey may not have been part of a terrorist cell, but based on previous investigations, chances are good he had some sort of help. The assistant director of the FBI in New York, William Sweeney, says they have no indication there is a terrorist cell operating in the area or in the city. Sweeney added that Ahmad Khan Rahmani was known by authorities.
There's nothing to indicate that currently he was on our radar. We had a report of a domestic incident some time ago. That was the allegations were recanted, and I don't have any other information. We'll keep digging.
Rahmani's bombing in the New York City area wounded 29 people. He is in the hospital recovering from a bullet wound after a shootout with police who were wounded. Prosecutors are charging the 28-year-old with 5 counts of attempted murder stemming from the shootout that wounded the 2 officers. Rahmani's alleged motive for the bombings is unknown. North Korea launched a ground test of a new high-powered rocket engine Tuesday, indicating the country is closer to acquiring long-range capabilities. North Korean state media says the successful launch was overseen by leader Kim Jong-un. A South Korean spokesman says Seoul believes that North Korea tested the performance of its new type high-powered thrust engine for a long-range missile. The new engine test comes less than 2 weeks after North Korea conducted its 5th and most powerful nuclear warhead test, which the country claims gives it the ability to fit a miniature warhead on a rocket. This is VOA News. The United States is accusing Syria of conducting airstrikes on aid trucks, which on Monday had been attempting to reach besieged Aleppo. The raid came as a tenuous week of ceasefire appeared to dissolve, with Syria's military blaming its collapse on U.S.-backed opposition forces. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said only Washington and Russia, the architects of the latest attempt to halt hostilities in Syria, could declare the ceasefire at an end, not Damascus.
The basic ceasefire is holding but fragile, obviously. Humanitarian assistance is moving today to some 8 different locations. But we're waiting to get the full download from our team that is meeting now with the Russians in Geneva. That process is continuing, and we'll see where we are in the course of the day.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking on Monday. The international community is pledging to improve its response to the global refugee and migration crisis. The announcement came out of a high-level summit Monday at the United Nations, where member states agreed to protect the rights of refugees and migrants and to share responsibility for large movements of people on a global scale. However, a plan to ask governments to resettle 10% of the world's refugees each year was dropped, and the final declaration has no requirement that countries take specific number of people, which has led to criticisms. Human Rights Watch said the declaration is a missed opportunity to widen the scope of refugee and migrant protections, asserting it limits expectations for concrete new commitments. Somali community leaders in the U.S. state of Minnesota are fearing retaliation after a Somali-American man allegedly stabbed 9 people at a shopping mall before he was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer. A Somali elder told VOA the community is worried about the impact from Saturday's attack. The police chief in St. Cloud, Minnesota, said the assailant made references to Allah during the knife attack at the Crossroads Center and even asked if one person was a Muslim. But authorities have not given a motive for the attack. The FBI is investigating the stabbings as a potential act of terrorism. And a powerful typhoon struck southern Japan early Tuesday, causing landslides and flooding. Typhoon Malakas has left tens of thousands of buildings without electricity and forced the evacuation of a nursing home, but there are no immediate reports of injuries. The typhoon is said to be losing strength as it moves northward toward eastern Japan. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington. Details on much more news, join us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC government blames criminal elements of the opposition for Monday's deadly clashes during an opposition rally.
Everybody has the right to demonstrate. Nobody has the right to kill and they loot and they destroy property. They came just to loot and destroy and kill.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe accuses some individuals of stoking what he calls the fires of xenophobia against migrants. An African community grows in a Texas prison town. And South Sudan says it has completed the withdrawal of forces from its border with Sudan.
The government of South Sudan has completed its withdrawal and it is now outside the buffer zone. The government of Sudan also has also done the same, and as such, we are in the process of normalizing our relations with the government of Sudan.
That's South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay, and evidence of tuberculosis has been found in people who are cured. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a protest against the president on Monday descended into violence. The Interior Minister told reporters late Monday that 17 people were killed, 3 policemen and 14 civilians. The demonstrators say President Joseph Kabila must step down when his term ends in December. William Klaus has the latest from Kinshasa.
The singing quickly devolved into angry chanting. Kabila must go, the protesters yelled. People built barricades to block the roads and burned tyres of vehicles in the pro-opposition neighbourhood of Limite. By 7:30 a.m., police were sporadically firing tear gas grenades. This man told VOA that, "We see that all the Congolese are here to reclaim the rule of law. I am a young Congolese and we need a change. We need elections within the constitutional time frame. We will chase Kabila from the country by force." Several thousand opposition supporters were gathering in Limite and at other points around Kinshasa. The plan was to march around the city before a delegation of 50 opposition leaders delivered a petition to the Electoral Commission. The Kinshasa governor had authorized the plan. Instead, the situation quickly became tense and chaotic. Opposition leaders say that police intimidated their supporters, dispersing them as they gathered and blocking their approach to the central meeting place. At midday, riot police and soldiers were stationed on the road leading to that meeting place near the Parliament building. The OA saw security forces stopping at least 5 people who looked to be foreign observers and loading them into the back of vehicles. An opposition leader told the OA by phone that he and others were penned in one of their party headquarters and unable to leave. A Congolese government spokesman told AFP News that the government decided to cancel the demonstration after supporters of veteran opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi murdered 2 policemen in Limite. George Kapiamba, the president of the Congolese Association for Access to Justice, told VOA that his team has seen the bodies of 7 people who witnesses said were killed by live rounds fired by the security forces. Monday marks the day the DRC's electoral process should have kicked off ahead of November polls, but the Electoral Commission now says that the poll should be pushed off until 2018. It says that time is needed to compile a new voter list. The leaders of the opposition coalition, known as Le Rassemblement, or the Assembly, say President Kabila is deliberately delaying polls to give him more time to change the constitution so that he can run for a third term. Kabila has not spoken publicly on the subject, though some of his supporters have called for a referendum to remove term limits. Across town, behind closed doors, the government and a smaller faction of the opposition are thrashing out an agreement over election dates. Participants in that dialogue have raised the possibility of an interim power-sharing government once Kabila's mandate expires in December, but have given no additional details. The Rassemblement has dismissed this dialogue as a sham and boycotted it. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is blaming what it calls criminal elements of the opposition for Monday's deadly clashes during an opposition rally in the capital, Kinshasa. A coalition of leading opposition parties, known as Rassemblement, had called for a nationwide rally Monday to demand President Joseph Kabila call elections and leave office by the end of the year, as stipulated in the Constitution. The group had also said it was going to present a petition to demand the resignation of members of the Elections Commission. But Information Minister Lambert Mende said instead of presenting their petition, the Rassemblement hired young people and gave them drugs to loot and destroy property. He said some Kinshasa residents defended their property, leading to the death of 17 people, including two policemen that were burned alive.
Kinshasa City gave the go to deliver a petition to the Electoral Commission today. Instead of delivering that petition, he landed in looting and hiring some very, very young boys, giving them drugs and sending them to destroy property, looting, killing policemen, destroying some police station around Kinshasa. So this brought a lot of soda during the day and brought to very dramatic incidents where people ended by fighting for their property. When those young people entered this private property to loot them, so people defend themselves, and we counted 17 people, including the two policemen they burned alive.
Minister, when we spoke with you on Sunday, you indicated that everyone had the privilege in the DRC to demonstrate. It seems to me perhaps were your police unaware that this was going to be happening? They were not prepared for it?
I'm wondering this question. Everybody has the right to demonstrate. Nobody has the right to kill and they loot and they destroy property. They were allowed to demonstrate. They didn't demonstrate. No documents were delivered to the Electoral Commission. They came just to loot and destroy and kill.
I was reading a statement from the Foreign Ministry of France saying that perhaps some of the things that are happening is because your government and President Kabila has not been very clear in terms of the election.
Is it really acceptable, James, that because the president didn't say clearly that he is not running, that you can kill someone because the president didn't say, "I won't run," since the Constitution is stopping him to run? This is stupidity. The Constitution already stops the president to run for a third time. So how can you go and kill people because he didn't say it, that me, Bill, I want to run? This is stupidity. This is criminal. What criminal?
Your interior minister has called the protest an uprising. What is the difference between an uprising and the protest, as the opposition call it? They call it a rally.
We can't say that this is an uprising because many opposition leaders are with us. They are busy discussing the national dialogue. Those were criminal elements that they are hired. I don't know if you saw image. You can see people, Italy, Blanca. You see that really they have consumed drugs. They're going here, a drunkard, going here and there, killing, burning, looting. This is not an uprising. It was a criminal activity.
Lambert Mendes, Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The South Sudan government says it has completed the withdrawal of its forces from the border with Sudan, as spelled out in the 2012 cooperation agreement between the two countries. But Sudan's ambassador to Juba says he is not aware of SPLA soldiers withdrawing from the area. YK Simon Wudu has the details from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Soldiers from Sudan and South Sudan were supposed to withdraw from the 1956 borderline between what was then Southern Sudan and Northern Sudan under the agreement. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe says the two countries agreed to withdraw their forces from the borderline following a recent visit to Khartoum by South Sudan First Vice President Taban Dengai.
The government of South Sudan has completed its withdrawal from the central line, and it is now outside the central line, outside the buffer zone. The government of Sudan also has also done the same, and as such, we are in the process of normalizing our relations with the government of Sudan.
The center line is a space defined in the cooperation agreement from which the two countries' forces were expected to withdraw 10 kilometers backwards from the shared border in order to create a buffer zone. The two countries share a long-contested and demarcated border which in recent years has become another flashpoint between South Sudan and Sudan. Relations between the two countries soured following clashes between their respective armies in the Higelech oil fields shortly after South Sudan declared its independence in 2011. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe says during the August 21st visit by First Vice President Taban Dengai to Khartoum, the two countries agreed to mutually finalize implementation of the agreement.
It is expected that the technical committee will be arriving here on the 27th for continuation of the talks in the operationalization of the provisions of the cooperation agreement by the JPSM.
JPSM refers to the Joint Political and Security Mechanism. But the Sudanese ambassador to Juba, Osama Berry, says he is not aware of any withdrawal of SPLA troops from the center line.
No, in fact, unfortunately, I'm not aware about this development from the South Sudanese movement. Only that is from the Sudan side. The redeployment has already took place since about June. Yeah, but I have no idea about the redeployment of the South Sudanese army.
The agreement between Sudan and South Sudan contains 9 issues affecting the border, security, oil, citizenship, and division of debts and assets. It was intended to resolve outstanding issues that Juba and Khartoum failed to resolve in the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement. 4 years after the agreement was signed, sticky issues have yet to be implemented. For example, the disputes over oil revenue sharing have not been fully implemented, and a border issue which would have seen a clear demarcation of the two countries' border in 3 months' time from the signing of the 2012 agreement is yet to be implemented. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The international community has pledged to improve its response to the global refugee and migration crisis, though some question whether the plan goes far enough. At a high-level summit on Monday at the United Nations, member states agreed to protect the rights of refugees and migrants and to share responsibility for large movements of people on a global scale. Speaking at the same meeting, Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe spoke about the positive contributions of migrants and refugees to sustainable development. He accused what he called unscrupulous individuals of stoking the fires of xenophobia by promoting a negative narrative of migrants for political expediency.
Mr. President, apart from natural disasters, large-scale movements are in great measure a result of direct acts of commission and omission by humankind. Consequently, therefore, more effort must be exerted towards peaceful settlement of disputes under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. More often than not, member states have been too keen to resort to force without exhausting peaceful means. This hegemonic military doctrine and adventurism, fueled by a desire to achieve the narrow national interests of a powerful few, is at the root of the proliferation of armed conflicts, which have spawned so many refugees today. Mr. President, some recent efforts to combat terrorism have tended to trample down upon the rights of migrant communities and refugees, while states have a legitimate right to take appropriate measures to protect their citizens from terrorism. There is great risk of mimicking the very same terrorist scourge should we, in the process, disregard and unwantedly violate their fundamental rights. Agenda 2030 recognizes the positive contribution of migrants to inclusive growth and sustainable development. As we gain traction in the implementation of that agenda, we should therefore be wary of a rising tendency by some unscrupulous individuals to stoke the fires of xenophobia and promote a negative narrative of migrants for political expediency. We have a collective responsibility to change that narrative on migrants and migration in our countries. Many countries owe some of the success in business and scientific prowess to the invaluable contributions of migrants and refugees. We commend those states that have, despite their own limitations, opened their borders to migrant communities. We in Zimbabwe have hosted many refugees from conflict-affected countries. We call for a balanced focus on the humanitarian plight of migrants and refugees well over.
That was Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe speaking Monday at a high-level refugee summit in New York. Most immigrants to the United States live in large cities, but many prefer smaller communities that offer a slower pace and proximity to rural scenery. One such place is Huntsville, Texas, where a community of close to 300 Africans now thrives. As VOA's Greg Flickers reports from Huntsville, jobs at nearby state prisons is what drew many of them to this city of just under 40,000 people.
Many of Huntsville's Africans can be found at the Rema International Church on Sundays to hear Pastor John Okperuve's fervent sermons.
Our God is a covenant-keeping God.
Pastor John says most members of the flock are Nigerians like him, but not all.
Being an African church, it serves as a meeting point to every African that comes down to Huntsville.
The church welcomes all who want to worship and celebrate. Ghanaian Peter Nyanor likes to wear traditional garb from his homeland.
Sunday has been a day that we use to remind ourselves that we still have a rich culture back home. Seeing your fellow people putting on the attire, it reminds you where you come from.
The church also lends a hand to newcomers who need support to get settled.
Everyone that comes that needs help, we try as much as possible. Within our limited resources, we help them out.
But the African population's growth is not from immigration alone. Many of the future leaders of Huntsville's African community are already here. Huntsville, a little over 100 kilometers north of Houston, is the location of the home and gravesite of Texas hero Sam Houston. Sam Houston State University, with its diverse mix of students, and the headquarters of the Texas Criminal Justice Department, which operates nearby prisons. Job opportunities in prisons have drawn Africans to Huntsville. Most of the Sunday congregants are prison guards, including the women.
When you're in the workplace, your co-worker is the family you have at that point, because if anything goes wrong, he or she will come to your rescue.
She says many American co-workers, including African Americans, are curious about her culture.
I've had certain co-workers who will come to me, "Oh, I want to learn Igbo. Can you teach me how to speak Igbo?" And I'll be like, "Sure, I can."
There are enough Africans here to support a small store with products from the home continent. Next door, Pastor John visits T-shirt shop owner Nathan Smith, a fellow Christian who has become a good friend.
I've met people from Africa before, but never witnessed an African church before. And I've been over there and experienced their service, and they're real humble and real down earth, and they worship and they love God.
Pastor John says he's encouraged integration with the larger community in Huntsville, something residents like Kathy have welcomed.
I think it's great. I love diversity. I think it's wonderful.
Pastor John and his church have supported local charities and events, building a sense of belonging for African immigrants within the community at large. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Huntsville, Texas.
Researchers are scratching their heads following the discovery that tuberculosis may not be completely gone in those who are deemed cured. A recent study found that evidence of the bacterium that causes TB remains after treatment. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Months after being treated for pulmonary tuberculosis with a rigorous antibiotic regimen, 99 HIV-negative individuals in Cape Town, South Africa, had their lungs imaged. Investigators at Stellenbosch University used a CT scan, a more detailed form of X-ray, and PET scans that glow brightly to reveal the presence of lung abnormalities. Imaging in 76 of those patients thought to be cured showed continued inflammation in the lungs and lesions similar to those of untreated patients. 1 year after treatment, 50 patients showed similar lung issues, although most of the lesions had decreased in size. 16 patients with some abnormalities picked up in the scans were otherwise free of lesions. Researchers also detected genetic material in the saliva and mucus of 34 patients, an indication that live bacteria remained in their lungs. The researchers were stunned.
Oh, yeah. They certainly were.
U.S. National Institutes of Health senior scientist Clifton Berry runs the tuberculosis research section and co-authored the study, published in the journal Nature Medicine.
We were quite surprised to see the residual findings at the end of treatment and the evidence of presence of actually live bacteria in patients that we called cured of tuberculosis.
Barry says investigators do not know what the implications are. Could such patients relapse? And if so, could their infections become resistant to antibiotics? A six-month course of antibiotics has been the gold standard in treating TB patients who afterwards usually show no symptoms of the disease.
I think the question is, you know, is that really enough? And do we need to think about potentially looking more carefully at patients at the end of treatment and evaluating in a different algorithm how we treat individual patients?
One-third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 9.5 million people become sick and 1.5 million die. In more closely assessing TB patients, researchers say treatment regimens may need to be tailored to different individuals. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo say at least 17 people have died during protests calling for President Joseph Kabila to step down. Officials say the death include 3 policemen and 14 civilians. The violence began Monday morning as police prevented protesters from gathering in the capital, Kinshasa. And the international community has pledged to improve its response to global refugee and migration crisis, though some question whether the plan goes far enough. That's it for this Tuesday, September 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, the 71st United Nations General Assembly is underway in New York, including a first-of-its-kind summit of heads of state and government to address large movements of refugees and migrants with the aim of bringing countries together behind a more humane and coordinated approach. We'll discuss that and other issues next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight, comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.